Hello, and welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. If you enjoy this conversation, there are a few different ways you can support us. You can buy a book from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, including the title discussed in this episode, a link to which you'll find in the show notes. There, you'll also find our Year of Reading subscription, as well as Shakespeare & Company totes, apparel, mugs and other gifts, all shipped from Paris to wherever you are in the world. You can also become a friend of Shakespeare & Company, a programme we set up to get the bookshop through this difficult year. Membership gets you access to exclusively produced content throughout 2021, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Contributors so far include Molly Crabapple, Aishan Hutchinson, Olivia Lang, Deborah Levy, Kartika Nair, Clémence Poésie, Natalie Portman and George Saunders. You can find out more on friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. Finally, you can rate this podcast wherever you listen, and if you have time, leave a review. It can really help spread the word. I'll be back at the end. Until then, thank you for listening and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. At a moment in The Island of Missing Trees, Elif Shafak writes that, "In real life, unlike in history books, stories come to us not in their entirety, but in bits and pieces. Broken segments and partial echoes. A full sentence here, a fragment there. A clue hidden in between." If this is so, then despite being steeped in painful, real events, specifically those leading up to the division of Cyprus in 1974, The Island of Missing Trees is much closer to real life than a history book. It's a many-threaded story that straddles a continent, Europe, an epoch from the 1950s until today, and even the boundary between species. For one of the book's characters, in many ways its main character, is neither human nor animal, but, well, we'll come to that in our discussion, I'm sure. William Boyd called The Island of Missing Trees a wonderfully transporting and magical novel that is, at the same time, revelatory about recent history and the natural world and quietly profound, while Robert McFarlane declared it a brilliant novel, one that rings with Shafak's characteristic compassion for the overlooked and the underloved, for those whom history has exiled, excluded, or separated. Elif Shafak, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure, and it's so nice to have you back at Shakespeare & Company, if only virtually for now. Where I'd like to begin our conversation today is where the book itself begins, actually, because there are so many different characters, so many different ways into the book. But you begin your story with Ada. I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly. Ada or Ada, as we say in France. What would be?
I would say both. I mean, in Turkish, it would be Ada, meaning island. But having grown up in the UK, probably she would call herself Ada. So either way. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's a very important point, actually. So Ada grew up in the UK and in many ways is the, I guess we could say, almost the culmination of the story that you are telling in The Island of Missing Trees. At least the sort of so many of the different stories that you will unpack in this book ultimately feed into making Ada the person she is and making her react in the way she does to a specific situation, which we'll talk about in a minute. But why was it important for you to start essentially with the destination of this story, Ada, rather than with her parents and their backstory?
Well, thank you. You know, I'm so glad we started with this because in many ways, it was one of the central questions in my mind. I wanted to think about inherited pain. Mm-hmm. Does such a thing exist? I've been observing so many families of immigrant backgrounds, families in exile, but also families with complex backgrounds and histories. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting for me to see these generational differences. The first generation, I would say, those are the ones who have experienced perhaps the biggest traumas or displacements, but they don't necessarily have a language to mm-hmm. speak about these things. The second generation doesn't want to talk about the past usually mm-hmm. because they're busy adapting, finding their feet, you know, building a new life. But it's then the third or fourth generations, in other words, the youngest in the families, who are asking the biggest questions about identity, the mm-hmm. stories of their ancestors, where do we come from, you know? So you might meet young people with old memories, mm-hmm. sharing the memories of their grandparents. So this is a book that very much deals with intergenerational trauma, memory, the things we find difficult to talk about in our families, both family stories, but also family silences.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, in a way, such an obvious idea that grief and that trauma can be passed down the generations. It's something we're very comfortable with talking about on the subject of genetics, for example, that characteristics or illnesses can be passed down from one generation to another. But it seems often we are quite squeamish a little bit about talking about these sort of things, particularly when it goes several generations back, as affecting the lives of, as you say, second or third generation immigrants.
Which is very interesting, because as you said, when it comes to physical illnesses, or it doesn't necessarily have to be an illness, physical traits, we're more willing to recognize how things can be passed down from one generation to the next. But equally, I mean, in this book, nature plays an important role. Mm. So there are very interesting studies that show trees that have experienced some kind of trauma react differently to upcoming traumas. Mm-hmm. And so trees that have descended from ancestor trees that have experienced some kind of trauma might also react differently. So we're also willing to recognize it in the animal world and in the world of plants, but not so much, as you said, when it comes to human beings. But I think these are important conversations to have. Mm. And it shapes us, not only the stories that we hear, the memories that we hear, but also the absences, the things that we might not know much about, but nonetheless, they're there. And through the silences, through the unspoken words, still things can be transmitted from one generation to the next. And I think many young people are really asking these questions right now.
Mm. And I think definitely that sort of feeling it, but not being able to necessarily articulate it, is definitely the situation we find with Ada at the very beginning of the book. So we meet her and she's in a history class. And I think I could talk about this because it's right at the beginning of the book. It's not giving too much away. But she has this kind of strange sort of sensation overcome her. And the only thing that she can, I was going to say can think to do, but it's not even necessarily something reflected upon like that, but she stands up and she screams.
Yeah.
Often you would come across something like this in a book and you think, like, sort of, oh, I think writers would often be reluctant to include it in a book because it might not sound particularly believable. Whereas in fact, we know from our own experience and from the experience of people around us that we have these kind of inexplicable sort of psychological reactions on a day-to-day basis.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I think, especially right now, where we are in this moment in time with the pandemic, with the climate crisis clearly accelerating in front of our eyes and widening inequalities, deepening inequalities across the world, mm-hmm. I think many people feel like there's a scream building up inside. So mm-hmm. both individually but collectively, we have a scream waiting to be unleashed. Mm-hmm. And it's quite ironic because this was supposed to be an age in which we would all find an equal voice thanks to the spread of digital platforms. Everybody was going to have a voice. And yet the truth is so many people across the world, East and West, feel voiceless. Mm-hmm. People feel like their voices are unheard. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in that. And if I may add this, I don't know if you've seen this picture of this elderly lady from the wildfires in Greece, in Turkey, in Greece, we had horrible wildfires. And this woman who has lost everything, her village, her home, the world that she has known, it's incredibly painful. Somebody on social media had turned that photograph into a painting. Mm. And it strangely resembles Edvard Munch's painting, the famous painting, The Scream, in which actually not the person at the center, but the whole surrounding world is screaming. Mm-hmm. So all I'm trying to say is it's not only human beings that are screaming, it's nature itself, it's trees too, as our world is being destroyed. It's just a matter of hearing. So in many ways, I think for me, scream was an important symbol.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned trees a couple of times, and this is the elusive extra narrator I was talking about in the introduction. This may be quite a strange thing for our listeners to hear if they haven't read the book, because the idea that a tree could be articulating a story feels quite left field, feels quite sort of off the wall. And yet when you read it in the Island of Missing Trees, it feels very natural. It feels almost as if the story couldn't have been told without this non-human, non-animal perspective. And I'm curious to know, in the conception of this book, in the development, in the writing, when it became clear to you that you would have to take this quite radical step of giving voice to a tree?
It was a radical step, to be honest. And it was quite challenging and risky because, you know, it might not work to have a tree speak, can be even off-putting. So it was a risk. But the truth is, I have been wanting to write about Cyprus for a very long time. I've been reading about it, researching, thinking about it. Obviously, this is a beautiful island with beautiful people, you know, on both sides. But it's also a very difficult story to tell because the past is not a bygone affair. The past is very much alive and breathing in this very moment. It is a divided island, and also it's a place where there's accumulated grief and pain, and the wounds are unhealed, they're raw still. So how do you tell the story of a place that has been experiencing this kind of civil war, ethnic violence, partition, without yourself falling into the trap of nationalism? How do you tell such a difficult story without yourself repeating the codes of tribalism? That's a difficult thing for an author. So I didn't know how to approach the story, and I could never dare. Until I found the fig tree. And only then, I think, it gave me a chance, a freedom, and maybe a little bit of courage, an opening to approach the story from a completely different angle. And if I may quickly add this, when I lived in America years ago in Ann Arbor, Michigan, it was very cold. And I've seen some immigrant families coming from the Mediterranean, Italy, for instance, who would bury their fig trees when the winters were very harsh. So the fig trees would stay under the ground, buried for 2 or 3 months, depending on the winter. And then come next spring, they would unbury them. I remember that. And I started doing more research. And then you realize, actually, there are many immigrant families who are familiar with that botanical technique that helps trees to survive. So that notion of burying and then unburying the secrets is also a theme that is central for the book. And the tree gave me a chance to think about roots. How does it feel to be uprooted, almost deracinated, but then also be rerooted? So I do care about roots a lot.
I'd like to unpick a lot of things you just said, but just as a quick sort of a side point about the idea of sort of approaching the story and not wanting to be seen as sort of partisan one way or the other. Was that something you felt particularly sensitive about, obviously coming from a Turkish background, of having that sort of the reception of the book might be received in a way that people would sort of brand it, in a sense, a kind of a Turkish perspective on the situation?
The thing is, you know, I think I'm very critical of ultranationalism. I'm very critical of religious fundamentalism and any ideology that divides humanity, humankind, into groups and claims that one group is superior to other. Is, you know, something I'm critical of. And I don't think that's the perspective of a storyteller. You know, for a storyteller, there is no us. There is no us versus them. And actually, the other is my brother. The other is my sister. I am the other. Those are the bridges, or those are the connections that I think storytelling very much relies on. But it's difficult to write because we're talking about clashing memories. And those clashing memories are transferred from one generation to the next. I grew up in Turkey with lots of stories about the Greek side, just like many Greek people, you know, writers, for instance, have grown up with stories about the Turkish side. So there are these clashing narratives, and we need to find a new language. And perhaps we'll talk about this. One of the things that gave me the courage is this actual committee that exists in Cyprus. It's called the Committee on Missing Persons. And it's incredibly moving what they're doing, because Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots are working together. And they are literally burying the ground in order to find the bones of the missing, not in order to revive old animosities, just the opposite, but to give the dead, for, first of all, a proper burial, dignity, but also the families a sense of closure. And these are the people who are volunteers, and they believe in a better, fairer, together, you know, future together. This is an important subject, those exhumations. It's not only happening in Cyprus. It happened in Spain after the Civil War. It happened in Guatemala, in Chile, in Argentina, in Iraq, in Bosnia after the genocide. So I think memory is a responsibility to unbury the pain of the past in order to build a better future and hopefully never, ever to make the same mistakes again.
And that idea of closure, I think, is very important, particularly on the time scale that this book is working on, because in a sense, you know, human lives are limited. And if you are, this goes alongside this idea of sort of grief being passed down generations. If you are losing the people who were there when something happened, you're losing a very important connection to what caused the grief or the trauma, and potentially what might help to heal that grief and trauma. And that's one thing that I did find very moving about this organization that you talk about in the book, is this sort of this sense that sort of they were racing against the clock, in fact, because this is something which dates back to the 70s, but also like a little bit before. And so the people who would have been young then are old and starting to leave us. And so it really felt like there was an urgency to this this reconciliation that was taking place.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting that it's the young people who are very much aware of that urgency. As you said, this committee was formed by United Nations. You know, UN brought people together, but at the same time, it's composed of volunteers, many of whom are women, many of whom are young, and there are people of all walks of life, anthropologists, forensic specialists, or just people joining in and helping with the excavations, exhumations. And you're very right, they're literally racing against the clock, because when the oldest generations die, there will be no one to tell where the missing might be buried. So they understand the urgency of memory. But if I may sidestep for a moment, you know, I come from a country that has a very long, rich history in Turkey. That doesn't mean, however, we have a strong memory. Rich history doesn't mean strong memory. I think in Turkey, we're a society of collective amnesia. So when you are a novelist, when you're a fiction writer from such a background, maybe you learn early on that silences matter. And as a writer, you become interested not only in stories, but also the silences, the things we cannot talk about easily. And that's why for me, rather than paying attention to the center, what I'm much more interested in is the periphery, the untold stories, or people who are left voiceless, or people whose stories have been erased. Yeah. That's what I want to, you know, give more voice to.
I would contest also that Britain is very much a country that has a sort of a strong sense of history, but actually very little knowledge of the events, you know, the specific events of the history, and specifically the brutality of British history, in the construction of empire and things like that.
Indeed. And these are very, very important conversations that actually we're having right now across the UK. But as you pointed out, not many people want to hear these conversations. But I think they're very important. So when it comes to public statues, what do we remember? Because statues are not about history. It's about memory, what we remember, but it also is about what we refuse to remember, right? What we have erased, what we have unlearned. And I think there are many people who rightly say, wait a minute, what about my ancestors' history? You know, most of history is actually his story. First of all, where are the stories of women? Where are the stories of minorities? At the end of the day, I think every nation state has its own official version of the past. In that regard, nation states are similar. However, where there is a big difference is in a democracy, you can walk into a bookstore and you can find many books that challenge, question, and rightly so, that official narrative, which is imposed top down. And the authors of those books are not prosecuted. You can come across journalists who write long investigative pieces, you know, about forgotten stories, and those journalists are not imprisoned. In a non-democracy, all the other voices are suppressed and one single narrative will be imposed from above. And mm-hmm. that makes a huge difference, of course. Mm.
And that kind of, in a sense, brings us back to the subject of trees, which I'd like to unpick a little bit more, because one of the perspectives, I guess, that the writing from the In the Voice of a Tree gives you is it's a non-tribal perspective, it's a non-nationalist perspective, and also it's a perspective which can extend over generations as well. The sort of the time scale on which a tree lives and experiences the world is completely different from a human time scale. I'm interested by this presence of trees because I have the feeling that over the last few years, trees have been very much in the sort of the literary zeitgeist. I mean, off the top of my head, I think of Richard Powers, I think of Nicole Krauss, you know, and of course your novel, and they're three very different novels, but all engaging with the subject of trees. And on the nonfiction side, there have been several sort of international bestsellers about the sort of the, you know, the secret life of trees, or what we're starting to understand about the way that trees live and the way that they communicate. And I'm curious to hear why you think that has happened now. Is it because of scientific progress and development of our knowledge there? Or is there something more kind of cultural, do you think, which has led us to sort of turn to trees in this way?
I think there's an important epistemological shift, but it's mm-hmm. not happening fast enough. Mm-hmm. You know, it needs to happen faster. We tend to think that we're the owners of everything around us as human beings. We think we're the center of the universe, mm-hmm. you know, and it's quite sad actually how we fail to see trees. Every day we walk by trees, but we don't necessarily see them. They are definitely much more sentient than mm-hmm. we think. And there is, even though there has been amazing research about trees, especially as you said, in the last two decades, there's still so much we don't know about them, mm-hmm. right? The way they communicate under the ground. I mean, when you think about trees, it's so remarkable. They make you question your understanding of intelligence, because we always attribute intelligence to the brain and that's it. But when you observe the life of trees, actually, you start to think of intelligence in a different way. Mm-hmm. But I think what I'm trying to say primarily is, you know, I think about all these rituals that indigenous tribes, for instance, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, I think about all these, the beautiful philosophy, the rituals that many indigenous tribes carried with them, and we have forgotten over the years. Mm-hmm. For instance, in Anatolia, there were nomadic tribes. One of them is called Tahtacı, like the people of the wood. It's mm-hmm. what it means. Before they would cut down a tree, if they had to cut down mm-hmm. a tree, they would form a circle around it, and they would ask the tree's permission. Now, to our modern ears, this sounds like nonsense. But I understand, you know, that way of seeing, mm-hmm. which we have lost, unfortunately. You will ask a tree's permission only and only if you don't see yourself as above, superior mm-hmm. to the tree, but you recognize that we're all part of the same ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And that is what we have lost, that sense of connection. Mm-hmm. And I think many of us are trying to say, as our planet is burning, you know, as our only home is burning, we need to reconnect with nature. Mm-hmm. We need to reconnect with trees urgently. And the second thing I need to emphasize is, I talk in this book about civil war, ethnic mm-hmm. violence, but there's also a part of me that wants to be able to say, wherever in the world and whenever there has been ethnic violence, it's not human lives only that have been mm-hmm. lost and destroyed. It's also the lives of animals and plants. Mm-hmm. And these are all interconnected, and we need to be aware of those connections too.
Mm. You put me in mind of something, and I can't remember where I read it now, but this with this interconnectedness that throughout history, there have been several examples of when civilizations have developed and built up, and obviously they generally require more building materials, so they cut down more trees in order to get those building materials. And there's been this kind of sort of correlation between as soon as the wood runs out, the civilization starts to collapse. And it seems sort of very sort of connected to that idea of this kind of codependence between humans and the natural world that, as you say, we're starting to learn, but maybe, well, certainly not not fast enough. As a storyteller as well, it seemed to me that it's sort of like beyond finding the voice of the tree, it seemed to me that it presented you with a lot of opportunities to tell a story in a different and particularly in a kind of non-linear way. Because I think one thing that is very clear about this book is this sense of sort of when you tell a story in a linear way, that's almost like it's only one line that you are drawing through a much more sort of complicated situation. Did you find that as a novelist? Like as soon as you had this idea of the tree, suddenly your storytelling possibilities increased?
Indeed. And as you mentioned earlier, there's a passage in the book that compares human time and tree time, and they're different things. Yeah. I've never been very fond of this linear time, to be honest. I think that's an illusion. So the notion that we live on linear time, which is by definition necessarily progressive, that tomorrow will be more developed and advanced than yesterday, is usually a myth. Now, tree time is different. It's more cyclical. It's more circular. And in that sense, I think tree time is closer to story time. So when I think about all the stories that I grew up with from my grandmother, now my grandma was not a very well-educated woman. She had been denied a proper education for being a girl. And yet she very much wholeheartedly supported women's education. And this was a woman who was superstitious, traditional in her own way, like the Auntie Mariam, maybe in this novel. But her house was full of stories, oral culture. And usually she would tell them in a more circular way, like opening one story within a story. So there are different ways of telling a story. And I think when you think of a tree's perspective, let's say, then history acquires a new meaning because trees live longer than us. They have seen much more than we have, and actually they're wiser than us because they've also seen the repetitions, how we can, as human beings, we can make the same mistakes over and over. So I really think we have a lot to learn from observing trees and thinking about what I call tree time rather than human time.
And the fact, I think, that which is very clear in the novel, that trees have this sort of dual existence in a way, their overground existence and their underground existence. Now there's, as you talked about, the moments of when trees are buried, and this was something I never heard about before, but that's interesting because then the sort of the dual experience becomes an entirely underground experience for at least a limited time. But I think also there's something that gives you certain opportunities to explore the idea of grief, the idea of trauma, like what you see above the surface is not everything. And in fact, what's going on under the surface is in many ways more vital to the life and the existence and the health of the tree, of what's going above surface, than we're generally aware of.
Absolutely. Which brings us to, I think, mental health, because there's so much that we still fail to talk about. And again, I think this is an urgent issue. We need to talk about mental health. We need to talk about anxiety, depression, the things we accumulate. But basically, we should also be able to talk about emotions. Again, where I come from in Turkey, people think women are emotional, men are not, which I think is nonsense. As human beings, we are all emotional creatures. But here in the UK as well, for instance, emotions are associated with weakness. Like you're not supposed to talk about them in the public space, but why not? I think it's an age in which many of us carry an anxiety inside, angst, like an existential angst. Also, there's anger, there's frustration, there's disappointment, understandably. And I want to be able to talk about emotions, but more importantly, what do we do with these emotions? Can we turn them into something more constructive and positive, both for ourselves as individuals, but also for our communities and societies? So it's incredibly important. And I think the book also talks about mental health, especially through one of the characters called Daphne, because she does carry those sorrows and melancholies and maybe the scars from the past, as you said, not necessarily on the surface, but underneath.
I think for Daphne, but I think actually for all of the main principal human characters, whether it be Ada, Daphne, Kostas, or Miriam, in a way, sort of each of them gives you an opportunity to sort of explore different aspects of mental health and different ways of grappling with processing and perhaps attempting to reach closure with the grief and trauma from the past.
Yeah, and that's also true for this other character called Aunt Miriam, who is more perhaps traditional. I have met women like Aunt Miriam. You know, I was raised partly by them or surrounded by them growing up in Turkey. And these are women who don't necessarily have a language to talk about difficult issues, complex issues. And they perhaps naively hold this belief that if they can feed you, if they can cook for you, they can express themselves. You know, food is a language. So for them, food is always more than food. And they also perhaps hope that if we could only sit around the same table and break bread together, perhaps we could understand each other better. Yeah, so when I look at the geography I come from, in the Middle East and in the across the Mediterranean or Levant, we have these baklava wars, right? The Lebanese say it's our baklava. The Syrians say it's no ours. We Turks like to think we make the best baklava. And of course, the Greeks call it Greek baklava. But at the end of the day, it's everyone's baklava. And that's the power of food. That's the beauty of food. It doesn't care about these nationalistic, national borders that we take for granted. So I'm very interested in the rituals of food, the history of food, but also primarily in how it transcends ethnic and national and religious boundaries.
That sense of boundaries as well is crucial to the book, because at its heart, on one of the storylines is a love story between somebody, Kostas from the Greek community in Cyprus and Daphne from the Turkish community in Cyprus. And it's very interesting to me, as somebody who didn't know a great deal about the situation in Cyprus, particularly pre-division, was the sense of the sort of communities living alongside each other with a certain sense of sort of coexistence and a certain peace, but also boundaries that still should not be crossed. So the idea of a romantic relationship between a Greek Cypriot and a Turkish Cypriot seemed to be very taboo, at least at least in the 70s. And it struck me as a very interesting idea that you could sort of be you could live alongside each other, but also be separated by certain certain taboos.
Indeed, and it's a novel that very much focuses on this notion of forbidden love. And maybe we can say there's two types of forbidden love in the book, but the primary one is, as you said, between Kostas, who is Greek and Christian, and Daphne, who is Turkish and Muslim. So there's also a religious division, and it's not an easy boundary to cross for young people. There are also gender codes. Which side can be, you know, can a woman come from the other side, then she must be converted to our side. You know what I mean? These expectations. I'm very interested in gender boundaries. I'm interested in also other questions, such as how homophobia works, what happens to sexual minorities at times of conflict. So there are several layers to this story of forbidden love. But primarily, of course, I think, you know, love does survive. Love does, interestingly, find a way, but it doesn't mean it's not scarred. It doesn't mean it's not wounded. And those wounds are there. So Kostas and Daphne, years later, they're able to come together, but they do carry the wounds. Maybe they experience that differently. One other duality that the book focuses on, because of their story, it's not easy for people to stay. You know, Daphne stays and Kostas leaves. And maybe it's a personal question for me too, because I don't go back to Turkey anymore. And I know that it's not easy to be an immigrant. I know it's not easy to be displaced or exiled, whatever you call it. But I'm very much aware that it's much, much harder to stay and to deal with the wounds, to deal with the scars. So Daphne is the one who stays behind. And so there's that duality explored in the book as well between those who leave and those who stay.
And that sort of sense of sort of the trauma and the cause of the scars, one thing that comes across very clearly is sort of how quickly a sort of a stable situation can escalate into conflict. And, you know, I'm not saying that the sort of, you know, as we said, that the relationship between the Greek community and the Turkish community, the Christian Muslim community, was never entirely harmonious. But there does seem to be a space over a few years, a few short years in the book, where they go from sort of maybe slightly antagonistic neighbors to all out war and then division. And it feels a sort of a very important lesson, particularly now, I think, for the last few years that we've lived through, whether we be, you know, whether in Europe, the United Kingdom, the United States, this sort of that when there are moments of division, they are not necessarily followed by moments of reconciliation. Sometimes they're moments of division, which then progress to conflict, even in societies which broadly looked stable or peaceful before.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is so important. This is why we cannot take it for granted. You know, I'm always very cautious when it comes to nationalism and nativism and tribalism. Sometimes people say, you know, our nationalism is different than other people's nationalisms. They talk about ugly nationalism versus nice nationalism. And I think that is an illusion. It takes just one political crisis or one financial crisis for a nice nationalism to turn ugly. So rather than encouraging, promoting more nationalism, I want to talk about multiple belongings. You know, I want to be able to say as a human being, I contain multitudes, like Walt Whitman used to say. And we've forgotten that. We don't celebrate pluralism. We make it sound as if you can either be one thing, or if, and if not, then that means you're the opposite of that thing. You know, which box do you belong to once and for all? And it is those boxes that we need to question. So when I look at myself, of course I'm an Istanbulite. Of course I'm Turkish. And I think those local roots are very visible in my writing. But I'm equally attached to the Balkans, the Mediterranean. I will always carry in my soul elements from the Middle East. I am a European, the values that I share. Over the years, I did become a Londoner, a British citizen. And despite what politicians have been telling us in this country because of Brexit saga, I want to call myself a citizen of the world. And that doesn't mean you're a citizen of nowhere. It doesn't mean you're floating in the air aimlessly without a care. Just the opposite, you know, you can care about many things. But then they say, well, that's you know, only for people who travel. I don't think so. Even if you're born and bred and raised in the same town all your life, you still have multiple belongings, whether it's your sexual orientation, the stories of your ancestors, your ethnic background, you know, many, many layers that compose a human being. But the trouble is we forgot to celebrate that. We started to see that as a problem. And I want to challenge that. I want to defend multiplicity.
Yeah, and I think that's it's also the case that the that contention that you are one thing, and if you're not one thing, then you're another thing, is actually a means of control by the people in power, actually, because it's sort of, if you can divide people, it's easier to rule people. If you can convince people that their neighbor, you know, the person across the ocean or in another town or in another region is their enemy, then it's easier to rule over them, in fact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. But that's how we lose, you know, coexistence. That's how we lose democracy. I think there's a reason why populist demagogues love divisions. They thrive upon tension. So as people who believe in democracy, we need to do better. We can have disagreements, but what do we have in common? You know, can we communicate across those tribes, epistemological tribes, is incredibly important.
Yeah. We've spoken a little bit in this conversation about the sort of the role of the storyteller and what the storyteller does. And there's one little extract which I'd just like to read to you, which I'm very curious to know if it is your view that you're expressing. And I know this is always a very dangerous question to ask of a novelist, and particularly after we've just had a conversation about how everyone contains multitudes, but I'm going to jump in and I'm going to ask it anyway. You write, "There are moments in life when everyone has to become a warrior of some kind. Mm. If you're a poet, you fight with your words. If you're an artist, you fight with your paintings, but you can't say, 'Sorry, I'm a poet, I'll pass.'" And I mean, I know this is a perennial debate about how engaged in politics and in issues a novelist or an artist should be. And I'm just very curious to hear where you feel your position is at the moment. Do you consider yourself a kind of an activist artist? And by that, I don't mean an activist and an artist, but somebody whose art is also there for sort of activist reasons.
It's a very powerful question, you know? And I think I will tell two layers. For me, as a writer, I think what I like most is to ask questions, including difficult questions about difficult issues. And I love to create open spaces where a diversity of opinions can be heard, and then always leave the answers to the reader, because every reader is going to come up with their own answers. So I don't like it when literature tries to teach or preach something. That is not close to my heart at all. But I think a writer's job is to ask questions and to open up conversations. Now, that said, I'm also very much aware of the fact that if you happen to be a writer from wounded democracies or lost and shattered democracies, you don't have the luxury of being apolitical. You know, you can't say, "I only want to talk about my fiction. I don't want to talk about what's going on outside the window," if so much is happening outside the window, and if that bothers your conscience. Also, I am a feminist, and one of the many wonderful things that I've learned from feminist movements of past generations is that politics is not necessarily what Boris Johnson does or Macron says or, you know, political parties do. It is more than that. And in that sense, the personal is also political. So you might be writing about sexuality and gender, but that too can be very political. So in that sense, I don't think literature can be non-political. And maybe many non-Western authors and also minority authors across the West are more aware of the urgency of speaking up about political issues. But that said, I am a fiction writer. And as I said, for me, you know, rather than the answers, it is the questions, the freedom of speech, the freedom of being multiple, and open up conversations is what I'm really longing for. And then leave the answers to the reader.
And indeed, based on what you were saying earlier, just that very action of opening up in itself is an inherently political one, when so many of the forces outside of art are directed towards closing things down, then anything that works to prise those things open again will have a political impact of some kind. I also think, I was thinking about this when going back over my notes just today, was that sometimes books can be prescient in a way that maybe was not intended. And it was just one line that I noted when somebody's talking about the situation in Cyprus and what happened back then. And you just write the line, "When Westerners run away like that, it means those of us they leave behind are in deep shit."
Yeah.
And, you know, with everything that's going on in Afghanistan at the moment, it sort of suddenly struck me that sort of how art can be both sort of political and can teach us and can educate us in things that are happening as we speak and that were not dreamed of when the novel was written.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for pointing that out, because I think it's so important. And this is a pattern that I think we've seen again and again throughout world history. And do we ever learn? I mean, what is happening in Afghanistan is truly, truly heartbreaking. And I want to have a more nuanced conversation about what's happening you know, without necessarily defending being there, but also the way the troops are pulled out so suddenly, so recklessly, endangering people's lives, including especially women's lives, but also the lives of LGBTQ plus minorities, the lives of human rights defenders, you know, anyone who speaks critically is very much in danger right now. And we cannot do that. I think, you know, next to the cries of Afghan women, for me personally, everything else feels very trivial. So how did we end up here? And we need to question. We need to, as global citizens, I think we need to be more engaged. And I find the situation unacceptable. And people don't realize that what's happening in Afghanistan or in one part of the world doesn't stay there. It has repercussions, ramifications across the board. We are all interconnected. Whether we like it or not, this is the reality of the world. So to think that by erecting walls, closing doors, we're going to be away from other people's troubles, it's just an illusion. In the age of pandemic, in the age of climate crisis or cyber terrorism, how are we going to solve these global problems with the forces of nativism and populist nationalism? There has to be an international awakening. And I think it's an important moment for global solidarity, but also especially global sisterhood.
Yeah. And I mean, and that you make me think of the moment when the US started pulling out and it was clear the Taliban were going to take over. And certain political commentators, all men, talked about, oh, this does appear to be a more restrained Taliban. And you can kind of hear the kind of the grim laughter of women in Afghanistan and across the world, sort of, and it sort of highlighted to me that sort of the coming back to this idea of multiplicity. I mean, if that is the kind of analysis that you're getting, sort of the mainstream kind of, for want of a better word, sort of patriarchal analysis, then you know we're just going to perpetuate the same problems again.
Indeed, and you're so right. I mean, these male commentators, usually they're men, are so ready, so willing to see this thing they call the new Taliban, or they talk about giving them a chance. I have seen coverage in Turkish media talking about the elegance of Taliban fashion, what they're wearing, you know, their clothes. So that kind of rhetoric that completely diverts attention from the pain and sorrow and fear of people on the ground, of women and minorities, is just unethical, unacceptable. And we cannot be this naive, if it is naivety that is causing it. But I'm with you. You know, I find these conversations very important. We, as human beings, you know, we owe each other. We are responsible for each other. And this idea that you can isolate yourself into groups based on sameness and you will be safer if you do that, it's a populist illusion that has no reality. We are all interconnected.
I'd like to, before we finish, because we are running out of time, but I'd just like to stay with this idea of sisterhood and the important role that that women need to play in sort of healing the wounds of the world and probably, in all honesty, saving men from ourselves, to be honest. That's one thing that I found in The Island of Missing Trees. The hope that is contained in it, and there is hope, is all embodied by the women, which is not to say, you know, and I don't want listeners to think that the sort of this is a book which is condemnatory of men. Not at all. I mean, the character of Kostas is incredibly empathetic and incredibly kind of sort of gentle, kind a person. But there's definitely something, particularly when we go back to Cyprus and we see what has become of Defne, and we see again this sort of this commission for missing persons, that there does seem to be something, the seeds of hope do seem to be contained in actions specifically that women are taking.
You know, I've been listening to people who have taken active part in reconciliation processes in Ireland, in different parts of South America, or South Africa, for instance. And it always struck me to see how women have been very active in reconciliation and healing and coexistence. They're both the carriers of memory, but also the ones who hopefully build that process of how do we, you know, how do we heal? How do we live together? How do we understand each other? Women can and do play an important, incredibly important role. I believe in a kind of women's movement that is also very much aware of the glass barriers within, among ourselves, whether it comes to race or class or ethnicity or geographical or regional or digital divide. So a much more intersectional feminism is very close to my heart. And so this is a kind of women's movement that I long for that goes hand in hand with LGBTQ plus rights and is very much cognizant of the fact that there is no way we can question patriarchy and discrimination unless we do it together. You know, these are not mutually exclusive. But at the same time, I think I want to be able to say that in a patriarchal society, clearly it's not easy to be a woman, but it's not easy to be a man either, especially to be a young man, particularly if you do not conform to given descriptions of masculinity. So you mentioned these other gentle you know, ways of masculinity that are never, ever being encouraged. Actually, you can be ridiculed. You can be shunned, you know, for not being manly enough. So a proper women's movement needs to open up conversations rather than retreat into just same, you know, tribes based on sameness. I want to be more diverse and inclusive and bring people on board. And I think if we can do that together, men and women and non-binary people and people of all, you know, from all sexual minority backgrounds, there is a lot we can change and challenge together. But if we are divided in this way, then the only thing that benefits from it is patriarchy itself.
That seems like a perfect place on which to finish. Elif Shafak, thank you so much for joining us today. The Island of Missing Trees is, of course, available from the Shakespeare and Company website or your local independent bookstore. So please do track it down. All that remains for me to say is, Elif Shafak, thank you so, so much for joining us today.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
For me too. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
You have been listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Links to the books discussed in this episode are available in the show notes, alongside information about how to become a friend of Shakespeare and Company. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please consider rating it wherever you listen. The intro and outro music is Mr. Ginger by the brilliant Alex Fryman, available on his album Play It Gentle. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care, stay safe, and thanks again for listening.